Welcome back to the KPO podcast. I'm your host, Jagisha. This week on the podcast, we are going on a true crime adventure. I got to interview investigative journalist slash author Sally Denton about her latest best-selling novel, The Colony, Faith and Blood in a Promised Land. This book is about the November 2019 murders of 9 children and women. It takes a deep dive into 2 Mormon outposts in Mexico. It's a fascinating book and an amazing interview. Please stay tuned.
This week, our guest is Sally Denton. She is here to tell us about her new best-selling book, The Colony, Faith and Blood in a Promised Land. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, to start off with, just tell us what happened on November 4th, 2019.
On November 4th, 2019, a caravan of women and children were brutally attacked while traveling through northern Mexico, leaving 9 dead and 5 gravely wounded. And the victims were members of the Lamora and Liberian communities, fundamentalists. I don't want to even call them Mormon because they had left the Mormon church, but fundamentalist polygamous communities whose forebears had broken from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon church, back in the 1800s and in the early 1900s. And when polygamy was outlawed, so they went to Mexico, basically, historically, to practice polygamy. But the case is still open. And basically, it was 3 women and 14 of their children who were traveling in the morning hours in a caravan, 3 SUVs, and traveling between these 2 communities, Lamora, which is in Sonora, Mexico, and Colonia Liberian, which is in Chihuahua. And they were all interrelated, and they were going to, 2 of the vehicles were going to a wedding in Chihuahua, and the other vehicle was going up, the woman, Ronita, was going to Phoenix to meet her husband. And they were attacked really brutally by as many as 100 gunmen with long guns and automatic weapons. And initially, there were thousands of rounds of ammunition. Initially, the Mexican government said that they were caught in the crossfire between 2 cartels. Mm-hmm. And then they said it was a case of mistaken identity. But as I started looking at it and researching it, it became very clear that it was neither, that they had been targeted. So my book, I took off where the original reporting, the initial reporting left off. And the initial reporting was very good among, you know, there were Mexican newspapers and actually newspapers from all over the world that covered it. So I took up where the initial reporting left off. And I mostly, you know, I just kind of wondered what these women were doing on this, the most dangerous road in the world. It's a major drug trafficking route into the United States. And my first question was, well, where were the men? Where were the husbands who let their wives and daughters travel these, basically a war zone? And they had been warned not to travel the road the night before. So I just started looking at that and ended up the book, The Colony, really looks at, I don't solve the crime itself, but I raise the possibility of numerous suspects, many of whom were very surprising to me.
Yeah, I was reading the book and I was also listening to the audiobook at the same time, and the description of what happened to the women, it was so chilling. I was just so horrified and chilled to the bone listening to it. So the narrator did an incredible job there telling us about what had happened.
Well, thank you. That was kind of, you know, it was very hard. And it's, as you said, it's a grisly, grisly crime. And initially, I mean, that's why I decided to write about it. I was so moved emotionally by the tragedy, and thought it was important to remember who the victims were and how this happened. And because of my own history, this is my 9th book of narrative history. Mm-hmm. And I had written 2 other books about Mormon violence, and also 2 other books on organized crime and drug trafficking. And so it was kind of in my wheelhouse to try and, you know, make sense of this. And immediately it was on CNN and everybody in the world watching television saw this. And it just seemed it was so heinous. These are, you know, young mothers and children and the brutality. One of the vehicles was not just attacked with over 300 bullets, but was burned with a grenade launcher, and the mother and her four children were burned alive. And it was videotaped by the gunman. And it was such overkill, mm-hmm. you know, it didn't require 100 hitmen. So it became very clear to me that this was, that this family or group was targeted. And so I really explored why.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, did you ever find out why they decided to go out alone this time? Because that wasn't normal. They made these trips multiple times, but usually men were with them.
Yeah, apparently they. It was not unusual for them to travel alone. It's interesting because the men, this is a patriarchal, pretty closed society of polygamists, and the men generally, it's a very dangerous area between, you know, controlled by various cartels, and the men traditionally traveled with a very sophisticated, almost military attaché protecting them. But apparently it was not uncommon for the women and children to travel just on their own. I mean, we're talking about, you know, families where the husband could have four or five wives mm-hmm. and, you know, 20 or 30 children. The women are often left. Well, they're also, you know, it needs to be said that they were these pecan farms that these community, that this family, the LeBaron family maintains in Mexico, are some of the most valuable properties in Chihuahua, and one of the most, you know, one of the top exporters of pecans throughout the world, including, you know, number one to China. So they're very wealthy, mm-hmm. and which has always, especially in recent years, has attracted the envious and angry eye of their indigenous neighbors as they watch them using a lot of the water that the neighbors and neighboring subsistence farmers claim is belongs to them. Mm-hmm. Now, also, as soon as it happened, then President Trump, even before Mexican law enforcement or intelligence had gotten to the crime scene, Trump was already tweeting that it was a group of, you know, American families that were attacked. And he announced that he was going to, his administration was going to see that the drug cartels were designated as terrorists, mm-hmm. which would give the United States an opportunity to intervene in Mexico, even you know, invade if necessary. And I knew from the beginning that was so completely misguided, because these were not some of the victims had dual American citizenship, but these are families that had lived in Mexico dating back to the 1800s. They were Mexican citizens. And so it was a false flag for then President Trump to even suggest that these were, it made it sound like they were, you know, traveling American tourists who were suddenly and randomly attacked.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Now, as you said earlier, the two communities had broken off from the Mormon Church, so the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So they were an insular set of community.
Right. And had actually been excommunicated by the Mormon Church mm-hmm. A long time ago. So, and they were among the only, you know, they went to Mexico to originally. Mormons left Utah in the 1890s to go to Mexico to practice polygamy because the then leader of the Mormon Church, in an expedient arrangement with the United States government, in exchange for statehood, which Utah Territory desperately needed by that time because of manifest destiny and the encroachment through Utah and the settlement of California, et cetera. The United States government would only give Utah territory statehood if they would abandon polygamy. It was basically a theocratic nation state mm-hmm. Under the rule of the Mormon Church. And so those who left, the renegades who left and went to Mexico to continue practicing, they saw themselves as members of the true church and mm-hmm. saw and believed that the Mormon Church's deal with the U.S. government was went against divine authority from Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon Church. So they were practicing, and even the colonies in Mexico were routed out by Pancho Villa in the Mexican Revolution in the early 1900s, and most of the Mormons returned to the United States during that time. Mm-hmm. And after the revolution, they returned to Mexico, to the colonies in Chihuahua, including families like Mitt Romney's family. Mm-hmm. But they, at that point, when they returned, they were mainstream Mormon. In fact, they built a temple, and there were practitioners of the mainstream Mormon church in Utah. It was only the LeBaron family and a sprinkling of a few others that continued, that went back to Mexico and were practicing polygamy. And so it's that clan that I really focused on.
Yeah. So tell us more about the women. Was it possible that the women were actually trying to leave this particular group? Because as you said there, it's a patriarchal society.
There are a lot of women who have left the group down there over the years, and many, some have written memoirs, and there have been a lot of investigative exposés of the colony. I mean, in a polygamous society, there's only one legal wife. And then because even in Mexico, I mean, polygamy is not legal in the United States, and it's not legal in Mexico either. Mm-hmm. It's been kind of condoned because Brigham Young, the then president of the church in the 1800s, made a deal with the president of Mexico. So they kind of overlooked polygamy. And there's certainly nothing in all the investigation that I did, and I got deep inside with drug enforcement and military and law enforcement on both sides of the border. There was nothing to suggest that these women were attacked because of they were from a polygamous colony. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one, as soon as this murder was so, you know, shots rang out across the world, it was so heinous and violent. There were many conspiracy theories that were floated. And among the most prominent one in the state of Utah at the time was that they were trying to escape polygamy. Mm-hmm. And escape and get to the United States. Now, there was only one of the cars that were traveling to the United States. The other two were going to the neighboring state of Chihuahua. The massacre happened in Sonora. So that was one of many conspiracies that came out. I didn't see anything to suggest that that was true, but certainly many, many women have escaped and told their stories once they got to the United States. And it was that sisterhood of women that I ended up relying on a lot for as sources for my information on the colony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, I mean, the story is incredible. I have to admit, I did not hear about this in 2019. And it's only now that your book has come out that I'm learning more about this.
Huh.
So were they having difficulties with the cartel? Now, I know you said that there's jealousy and there might have been issues with water rights, but were the communities having any type of difficulty with the cartel before any of this happened?
Well, you know, the LeBaron family predates the cartel. The Sinaloa cartel basically is in control of that region and has been for more than 30 years. And it was always under the control of El Chapo, Joaquin Guzman. It was just a couple of months before this massacre that El Chapo was finally incarcerated in the United States after controlling that region for 30 years. And so the region was in upheaval and chaos over the succession of Chapo. I mean, we're talking, this is a multi-billion dollar drug trafficking organization, one of the largest, if not the largest in the world. And but over the years, over these decades, the LeBaron family, as I said, predated the cartel there. So they've been on a handshake kind of gentleman's agreement between the cartel and the LeBaron family for 30 years. And it was not until there had been some scuffles along the way back in the early 2000s. But this was new, this kind of out and out battle. And it was not clear which of the cartels were involved. There were 100 gunmen. Mm-hmm. And from all accounts were from varying cartels and encroaching. It just became clear to me that there was this was a signal. This was a message that was sent to the LeBaron family. And I believe from my years of reporting about organized crime, including a book on Las Vegas, Nevada, on the mafia, a message like that is generally sent to one of the men in the family. And so that's kind of what I narrowed in on. Well, who was the target? And it seemed clear to me that the target was the vehicle that was hit with the rocket launcher and burned alive. So I focused more on that family specifically. And it was clear, you know, somebody had an axe to grind with the LeBaron family. So that's when I started looking at, well, who could it have been and why? And that's where I ended up finding so many different potential suspects and motives. And then, as you said, with the cartels, these are, you know, this is not a vacuum. This isn't a foreign entity. The cartels are members of, you know, they are born and raised in Mexico, the leaders and the workers and in the marijuana fields and the poppy fields and in the fentanyl and methamphetamine laboratories. And what became clear to me as I proceeded was, you know, that they were also competing with the pecan farmers who were diminishing the water table, the avocado growers who needed the water, the agave growers who for tequila, the lime growers, the marijuana, and, you know, all of the drug growers, and then the subsistence farmers. And so it was just a tinderbox, is a tinderbox still, as, you know, as climate change comes and it's becoming, this is the great Sierra Madre that was once rich with all sorts of resources that is drying up. And there's a lot of people fighting over dwindling resources, and the people have the different factions. These are all billion-dollar industries, but the different factions are also interrelated. So it's like a maze. It's very hard to tell. You know, the cartels, it's not just a phantom organization. These are people with deep roots in the land and in Mexico that are interrelated to people on all sides. And that's where it got very complicated.
Yeah, I did wonder about that. I would think that there would be people related to the women who were killed. And
well, absolutely. They even, you know, talked about having a cordial relationship with the cartels. They have to go through their checkpoints all the time, and they joke with each other, and they, you know, would give them peaches and pomegranates, and they would come to their rodeos, and the intermingling was so complicated. And you take that on top of these the LeBaron family, which is so inbred from generations of polygamy, that there's a lot of different people with competing interests, and there's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And there's even, if you read the book, there's a segue, of course, and that's not even a segue, it's a key role, is the violent blood feud within the LeBaron family itself, which could not be separated out from these events.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So now it's been 3 years, or about to be about 3 years. Are the relations still just as strained?
It doesn't seem like it. A lot of the families from the Lamora community went back to the United States after this happened. But the LeBaron, Colonial LeBaron, which has been there, as I said, you know, generationally, they've kind of burrowed in and are thriving financially, economically, as much or more than ever. The relationship, the violence seems to have, the threats and violence against the LeBaron family itself seems to have been toned down. But they are very, as far as I know, the community is really thriving. The region is still in chaos, as the Chapitos, as the sons of El Chapo are known, are competing with other factions. There's a lot of cartel factions within Mexico that are competing for this region and these transportation routes into the United States. The threats to the LeBaron family seem to have subsided. And so they've arrested, I mean, I think there's at least 75 people who have been arrested, but the case is still unsolved. Nobody has been arrested for the actual massacre itself. And as far as I know, none of the 75 plus people who have been arrested have been indicted or charged or are indicted or tried or convicted or incarcerated. So basically, the case is very much open.
Yeah. So could you tell us a little bit more about the blood feud you mentioned in the family, in the LeBaron family?
Well, part of the reason that the LeBarons broke from the Mormon church is in the 1950s, there were seven sons, and one of the sons, Joel LeBaron, claimed that he was carrying the bloodline and the mantle of Joseph Smith, mm-hmm. the founder of the Mormon church, and that he was what they called the one mighty and strong, and was the leader of, he started his own church, the Church of the Firstborn, and they had a lot of followers, and this was in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s and then actually 80s and 90s. But basically his brother Ervil decided that he in fact was the one who was the prophet and the one mighty and strong, and he had his brother Joel killed, and which was, you know, a very almost, you know, it was a classic Cain and Abel biblical tragedy. And then he went on and tried to become the successor and carry the mantle. And then he ordered the murder of a rival, Rulon Allred, a rival polygamist in Salt Lake City. And Ervil ended up in jail in Salt Lake and dying there. And, a very short time, but he left behind a hit list of 50 of his, as many as 50, some say 35, but as many as 50 were killed, rivals to his throne, basically. And a lot of these murders were carried out after he was dead, been carried out by his children. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and that was, he earned the moniker of the Mormon Manson in the United States. And that was a crime spree. Most of the murders were not in Mexico, but were in the Southwest United States. And so it's kind of a family that's been tinged with insanity and mental instability, certainly inbreeding with trying to carry on a purebred line by marrying first cousins. So, you know, it had a lot of history in violence before this event happened.
Yeah, it seems almost like it's a continuation of that.
One of the things he said, you know, did anybody think that they were trying to escape, that the women were trying to escape? I mean, that came up as one of the theories. And another of the theories was that this was a continuation of the blood feud, Ervil's hit list. And because he had vowed to kill everybody, all of the descendants of Joel, brother who he thought was the false prophet, mm-hmm. and one of the women was the granddaughter of Joel the prophet.
So in the course of your research, did you learn anything surprising, something that just you hadn't expected?
Well, all of it was surprising. I've written about polygamy before, and mm-hmm. so I knew about the pitfalls and the potential positive aspects according to people that practice it. So that didn't really surprise me. The biggest surprise probably was halfway into the research, and my books are all heavily researched. That's just kind of what the kind of writing and investigative reporting that I do. But what surprised me the most, I guess, was halfway into it, and I learned that there was a relationship between Colonia LeBaron and NXIVM, the colony in Albany, run by Keith Raniere, mm-hmm. who's now in jail for life, which was basically a pyramid scheme for self-help that on the surface that also doubled as a sex slave story, basically, in Albany. And I didn't even know about that until the trial of Keith Raniere came up during the course of my research, and there was testimony about 11 young girls, underage girls from Colonia LeBaron, who went to the colony in Albany, the NXIVM colony, under the auspices of working as nannies, that were then accused Raniere of sex trafficking. So suddenly, you know, what seemed like, I mean, it was always a complicated case, a complicated mm-hmm. massacre, but suddenly there was a whole other faction And Ranieri was deeply involved with Colonia LeBaron for almost 10 years, advising them and how to, you know, live without violence. And it was actually during those years that Ranieri was advising them that they had the most violence targeting them. So that was an unexpected, that was very much unexpected. But the whole story was fresh. I mean, when I got into it, this was a contemporary crime scene. So it's not like some of my books, which, you know, are 100 years ago in history. This is very contemporary.
Yeah. Wow. And it's such a tangle. It's incredible. I can't imagine trying to approach all this and put it together into a book.
Well, and that was another, you know, I was lucky that I had some of the skill set already in hand because of the two books I've done on Mormon. I did one on the Mountain Meadows Massacre from the 1850s. And then I did another book called Faith and Betrayal about my great-great-grandmother who brought the first piano into the American West as a Mormon convert from England. So I was already pretty adept at mining the genealogical websites and links of these families. So it was easy when I saw, you know, a forebear of the LeBarons as a key participant in the massacre of these women and children from Missouri and Arkansas in the 1800s, I already knew, you know, I had bloodlines already. It was like butcher paper on my walls full of, you know, who's connected to who through the generations. And that's thanks mostly to the Mormon Church, which is absolutely brilliant and fastidious at maintaining bloodlines, genealogical information. So that was much more available than it would seem.
Yeah. So as I'm reading the book, I'm completely in the story. I'm thinking, okay, are we going to figure out who did it, who didn't do it? It almost reads like a mystery novel.
Well, you're not at the end yet.
Yes.
It's funny. I was at a book event recently and I said, you know, for me, this started to become like a Murder on the Orient Express. There were, you know, who didn't have a motive, right? Or who wasn't in a fight with the LeBarons and who didn't have a motive to kill. And so then you start going through that. And I said that at a recent book event, and somebody in the audience said, it's not like the Murder on the Orient Express. It's like the Red Wedding in Game of Thrones. It's like everybody, you know, everybody has had a conflict with the LeBaron family dating back generations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, finding my way through those was the most complicated.
So as we wrap up, what do you hope readers take away from your book?
Wow. Well, I think there's a lot of, there are a couple of cautionary tales. In addition to the tragic humanity at play, it's a cautionary tale about the level of violence taking place that most Americans don't think about just across the border. Mexico right now is one of the most dangerous places on the planet, and America has a large role in that by flooding it with guns, and while Mexico's flooding America with drugs, and there's an insatiable appetite on both sides of the border for that, the willingness to arm violent drug traffickers with an endless supply of high caliber weapons. And then, of course, you know, if you look at, it's really, I mean, you know, as strange as it seems, the book itself is really a story about women. Mm-hmm. And if you want to see what it's like to live in a completely closed patriarchal society where the women have very little agency of their own and the husbands not only dictate what happened, but they get it in their faith, all worthy men can receive divine revelation. So that's something that if the man decides that this is how it's going to be done, there's no argument because it comes directly from God. So that, you know, it's far-fetched as far as the United States right now, but the curbing of women's rights, if you want to see a microcosm of what it is like to live in a communal society where the men are in complete control, look at these communities.
I know one of the things I read was that women can't get into heaven without their husbands.
Right. They have to cleave to, basically, the husband pulls them through the veil into heaven, which also sets up, I mean, not only on terrestrial, on earth, they're already, the wives are competing and their children are competing for, there's, I mean, a man could have 50 or 60 children and it's hard to provide for all of them. And the first, the favored wife and the first set of children get the priority. And then on top of that, that they can only get to heaven, you know, with a worthy man. There's competition among the wives and to attach themselves to the most worthy of the men, because they'll have a higher place in the kingdom, the celestial kingdom.
Yep, absolutely. So it's an incredible story. Thank you so much for writing it. I am just...
Thank you. Thank you for reading it and talking about it. I think it's a really important story.
I agree. It definitely, people need to know more about it. And especially because I agree with you on what you said about women's rights and what's going on in the country. So this is definitely a great way to look at it, that particular aspect of it.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. So are you working on something new?
I'm always working on something not related to this. I'm mm-hmm. going down a completely different path now, but not sure exactly. I haven't started a new book, but I'm looking at some different things. I've written a lot, as I said, about investigative history mm-hmm. and, you know, drugs and crime. And I'm thinking about departure from that, maybe into historical fiction.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot out there. Even if you still stayed focused on the Mormon Church, I think it's fascinating. The group that was in Missouri here, and then the break off, and just Brigham Young, and he's a fascinating.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, when this event happened, and when I decided to write a book about it, I didn't even really know that they were Mormon. I mean, it was not. I'm not like trolling Mormons or anything, and I'm mm-hmm. not a Mormon scholar. But as soon as I started looking at it, and I saw the ages of the young women and the number of children they had, I started thinking that this must be, you know, some kind of a fundamentalist organization, because most 29-year-olds don't already have 7 children.
Yeah. Yep. Well, okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you. I really enjoyed it, and happy to come back anytime.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's our show for this week. Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to end on a quote by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Crime is common. Logic is rare. Therefore, it is upon the logic rather than upon the crime that you should dwell. This is from his book, The Copper Breeches. Come back next week when we have author Richard Osman talking about his latest novel, The Bullet That Missed.